And now it's my pleasure to introduce Tim Wu. Tim Wu is an information policy advocate, a professor at Columbia University Law School, and chair of the media reform organization Free Press. A graduate of Harvard, he was named one of the university's 100 most influential graduates in 2007 by 02138 magazine, and he's been recognized by Scientific American as a leader in science and technology. He's perhaps best well known for coining the term net neutrality, but his work has also encompassed issues of copyright, international trade, and various aspects of information and technology policy. He's the author of Who Controls the Internet, and his work has also appeared in Slate, the New Yorker, The Washington Post, and other publications. His new book, The Master Switch, details the history and current state of communications policy, and argues that the fundamental differences between the information industry and other industries should be reflected in the in its regulatory policy. In his review for Boing Boing, Cory Doctorow writes that the master switch is fascinating, wide-ranging, and ultimately inspiring, and that Wu's great strength is the breadth of his scholarship and his ability to use humor, clear language, and innovative arguments to connect diverse ideas.
Hi, everyone. It's really a pleasure. Thank you for coming out tonight. I just, it's an honor just to have anyone come listen to me talk about the book. I usually teach, and the students kind of have to come. You know, they have no choice, and you can call on them blind, and, you know, you answer this question. But no, it's a real honor to actually have people come, ostensibly because they want to. Sorry? Let me tell you about NPR. I'll get to the talk in a second, but... I love doing NPR, but the strange experience about doing the NPR interview on Tuesday was sitting down, and I heard Robert Siegel's voice, you know, very beautiful voice. And I was like, well, NPR is on. And suddenly I realized he was talking to me. It was like this. It felt like the Statue of Liberty had come to life to shake your hand or something. It was a very, very strange experience. But I guess I should talk about my book. I'll give you a quick summary of what my book is about. My book is the story of information empires in American history. And so it is the story of the great companies, usually monopolies, the men who run those companies, and the tendency of rise and fall in this sector. It is more specifically a story of Western Union, AT&T, NBC, the rise of the Hollywood studio system, cable, the rise of the internet, and finally our current age, where an internet, which has been a revolutionary and very open technology, is increasingly controlled, and for better or for worse, by companies like Google, Facebook, telephone companies, and so on. So this is what the book is. If you pick up the book and read it, you'll find it. Most of it is a history. It's in narrative form. And a lot of it is about the people involved in these empires and what they were interested in. What I want to do today in the structure of the talk is to talk about what ideas or what things interested me to write this book and how they played out. And then to conclude by talking about, to take these two things I was interested in, see how they play out in the book, and then conclude with discussing our environment today and the current state of American information empire. So there's two things that interested me about when I began to write this book. I had worked for a long time in Silicon Valley, and like many people, I felt, and everyone around me felt, we were living in very different times, that our era was like no era that had ever come before. We were people living after the internet revolution. Much like after the American Revolution or after the crucifixion of Christ, there's a sense that nothing could ever be the same. How could, you know, this was the internet. Everyone can connect to everyone. And this is an ideology, a feeling, this sense that we live in very exceptional times in matters of how we communicate. Things are faster. more global, a pervasive, almost article of faith for anyone who works in these industries. And I think a lot of us, just from our daily experience, we have the sense that you have 1,000 messages in your inbox, new companies arise every day, that everything is just changing like never before. But I had an instinct that, I wanted to know if this had ever happened before, whether there had been other eras where a great new media had a medium had arose to change everything, whether there had been other technologies that were going to eradicate war, change the very nature of human existence. And so I wanted to figure out in some way whether the internet was actually different or whether it was following the same pattern established by technologies like the telegraph, the telephone, radio, cable, the other technologies that were revolutionary in their times. The other thing that has always profoundly interested me and fascinated me is something, a contradiction in the American character and maybe in human nature itself, which is the following. There is in the American tradition a great respect, a great admiration for things like competition, smallness, openness, the values of Adam Smith, the values of Jane Jacobs, the idea of small is beautiful. Yet the history of the industries I'm talking about do not reflect those values. They are rather a story of monopoly, powerful monopolies, and their consequences, repeated one after another. And so a lot of this book is a mediation on the American relationship with size. The contradiction between a kind of love or a stated taste, as I said, for things that are small, local, decentralized, open, and a tendency for this country to create mass giant information empires. There's other areas too, but companies like AT&T, companies like NBC, companies on a scale that the world had never seen before to rule over information. So those are the two things. And let me. And what I wondered in particular is whether there's something about us, Americans or North Americans, or even just as humans, as consumers of information, whether we read newspapers, watch news, or go to films, is there something about us that creates market power, that creates monopolies, that gives rise to Hollywood, to AT&T, to all these companies that dominated the history of 20th century American communications? So let me, it's obviously hard to talk a lot about history in a short time, but the book is full of stories which have the same essential repeating pattern, which in the book is termed the cycle. And I'll try to describe it briefly. Typically, something new is invented, whether it's the radio, telephone, or motion pictures. It goes through a period of some uncertainty. The initial inventor often has to struggle against efforts by existing firms to destroy or co-opt this technology. Eventually, the technology reaches a form and gives rise to what I call an open age, where suddenly it seems very easy for anyone to get in the market. And I'll give you a couple examples. About 100 years ago, anyone in this room could have started the telephone company. Just gone out, wired some houses together, started a little company, maybe the People's Company, Cambridge Telephone Company. It was actually, I think, a People's Telephone Company of Cambridge or something. They were very easy, right? Anyone just to start. It was a business that anyone could get into. 10 years later, it was very easy for anyone to start a radio station. I won't say anyone. You need to have a little bit of resources, but churches had their own radio stations, motorcycle clubs, radio amateurs all had radio stations. Anyone could be in this business. Film was an industry in 1910s, again, about 100 years ago. In 1914, I think there were 4,119 films made. In other words, 11 films made a day. Hundreds of producers, films on all kinds of topics. Now, these weren't, you know, Gone with the Wind. These were not Lord of the Rings films. These were short films with very limited special effects, people falling over and that kind of stuff. But there was something that almost anyone could do is be a film producer and be in the market. And that pattern has obviously repeated itself in our own lifetime. In the 1990s, I had many friends when I went to school here, went off to start websites. There are now a sense in the internet economy still that it's a relatively, well, we'll talk about this later, but especially in the 90s, that it was just something people got into, entrepreneurial, open. And there was also a sense, and I said this at the beginning of the talk, that in these the early film industry, the radio industry in the 1920s, something profound was going on. That somehow through the miracle of communications, humans might connect in new ways and start to overcome some of the greatest problems in human nature. That is to say, put an end to conflict, to war, to perhaps starting a new religious movement, to just a sense that something about these new technologies was going to change everything and, in fact, make it better. And things were never going to be the same again. What we then see in all of these industries is a shift that happens gradually. A number of factors are involved. But generally, some strong man shows up who takes the industry and manages to establish a more consolidated, more integrated rule. What was once a fragmented, very open industry, like the internet in the 1990s, becomes gradually, increasingly consolidated. Now, part of that comes from the consumer, and this is what really interests me, is that typically the open industries, film 1910, the internet 1990s, are attractively diverse and new. There's a novelty to them. But they're often quite unreliable. Quality may suffer, maybe somewhat amateurish. They don't have the size or the scale often that consumers want or Americans want. And so, for example, in the film industry, the original of the Hollywood studios, Paramount, run by a man named Adolf Zucker, pioneered a very different kind of film where he took the methods of Carnegie Steel or the Ford Motor Company and applied them to film. He said, what we need to do is we need to integrate every step of the production process. We need to own the actors, we need to own the cameras, we need to own the studios, all the distribution mechanics, all the way to the theaters. Everything that is film we need to own. And then with guaranteed audiences, with long-term contracts, he would be able to create what we now call the Hollywood film. Special effects, Gone with the Wind, King Kong. People liked it. Created a golden age, according to some. Gained was a new higher quality. Lost was the diversity and quantity. In the telephone networks in the 1910s, there was a period, as I said, very entrepreneurial. Anyone could start a company. It was a small company in Cambridge. But all these scattered telephone networks made it very hard to reach people. Quite confusing. AT&T, in the 1910s, headed by a man named Theodore Vail, who's a pivotal figure in the book, picked these pieces together and, like a conquering emperor, put them together into one giant kingdom called AT&T. And anyone who resisted him was crushed. And he put the American phone system together into a single monopoly, effectively gained the assent of the American government, and ruled telecommunications for 70 years. Radio is a similar story. 1920s, I said, very diverse, very open time. AT&T, and I don't want to tell the full story, but AT&T was involved in that industry as well, in an idea of what was called the network. This was the idea of making one show and sending it to 20 radio stations, instead of 20 old radio stations making their own shows. You can see that if you combine the resources, the amount of revenue available to an audience of 20 or 100 or 1,000 radio stations, you'll have a lot more money to make higher quality, at least it was called higher or more production, higher production value shows. And so on that basis, you saw the rise of NBC in the late 1920s. And particularly important in that story is a federal government interest in creating a single centralized, or not single, but a centralized radio system to serve the American public. So you have this repeated story that I call the cycle. From open and fragmented to closed and consolidated systems in American information. And my book is mainly the story of those cycles. Let me take you where that takes us today. We are sort of in the midpoint of what you might call an open era in American communications. The internet, popularized in the mid-1990s, is now 15 years into its rule. At this point in radio history, radio had already been gone from being the darling young technology of American amateurs to being what Joseph Goebbels called the spiritual weapon of a totalitarian state. That is to say, in 15 years of radio history, radio had already gone from sort of a beacon hope to a tool of the Nazi regime and of the Soviet regimes, actually, at the time, used to indoctrinate citizens. So the internet's doing better than radio. We can say this much. But the ancient and repeated power patterns of consolidation and integration are showing themselves again. And for better or for worse is something I'm going to leave somewhat open for debate. Let me just ask, how many people here use Google? Or maybe how many people don't use Google? Well, that's impressive. What do you use? The point is that Google... We'll get to see, but the Google has a monopoly over search, and I like Google. I use it myself. I love it. It's an attractive technology, but it has a monopoly over search that is undeniable. And it raises the question. All of us use Google, and we have created the Google monopoly by our choices. It's not like it was somehow foisted on us. The federal government, no one's been involved. We just have chosen it and made it king, essentially. And ask the familiar question that recurs through my book, is the question of whether we actually, in some level, love information monopolists, so long as they are good. This was a deal that AT&T struck with the American people in the 1910s. It said, we will be good. They didn't quite say it like that. They said, we are a public utility. Our duty is to serve the people. We will deliver a national telephone system, the best in the world. All we ask in return is a monopoly forever. And so we said, great. Some level, to ask whether Americans at some level prefer, even though we have a republic, have a certain taste for attributes of monarchy. Absolute power, as long as it's handled responsibly. That is the question that Google raises today. Question number two that I think is raised by today's events, where we can see some of the same patterns reasserting themselves. Isn't a company like Apple? Apple's a very interesting company because they are copying, Steve Jobs is copying almost letter by letter the strategies used by the Hollywood studios in the 1920s. That is to say, he's pursuing a strategy of integration, of putting everything together. When you think about it, I don't know if you use iPhones or Macs, but the motto of them could be a motto from BBC in the 20s, the best of everything. You have networks, which are relatively fast. You have the devices themselves, which are beautiful. And Steve Jobs himself, using his charisma, has brokered the best deals with record labels, Hollywood, New York media, to give you the best of everything on the world's most beautiful devices. It is a compelling product. It has the same appeal that Hollywood film had in the 1930s. And that ideology is at our present in a war with Google, with the Internet's values, which is part of what's so interesting, is the Internet revolution was by design very different. It was meant to be or create, perhaps forever, a fragmented open system. But now we have a man who promises something beautiful, integrated, seamless, that works great, but it isn't open. And I guess I'll close on this final question. I'm about out of time. I guess the question for people who are interested, and I think this is everyone, I think everyone is interested in information because it makes you who you are. And everyone is interested in the tools we use every day, whether it's the Internet, whether it's search engines, Facebook, or telephones, because they are our tools today. Humans are tool-using creatures. These are our tools. And so we have a natural interest in how something you use every day, you have a natural interest in how it works or where it's going. So part of what's very interesting is whether, in fact, again, we come back to my initial question, are we living in special times? With the rise of the Internet and sort of a more open, a place where you can surf blogs or go into Twitter, and there's a million apparent sources of information. Is that just a phase, or are we headed in some way back to the patterns in the 1940s, 1950s, very comforting, where the whole nation essentially watched the same things at the same time? Maybe it'd be a little different, but that is the question. Every time you write a book, you have to decide what not to put in your book and what to put in the book. And I didn't write about publishing, not because I don't think it's interesting, but because when I looked at the history of publishing, I realized I'd have to go back to the 15th century. And it was it was very much also an English and European story. So it's not, there's no principle behind it. It's just the limits of space. Yeah, no, publishing's the same story. Yeah. You know, I haven't studied it in the same detail I've studied these other markets, so I don't want to, like, sort of offhandedly say, yeah, it's exactly the same. But my instinct is the publishing has very similar patterns, which I wonder if my publisher would like me saying that, but anyway. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks. I think that the reason I chose the word information is I think that what is ultimately going on here, I think it's the most basic word, the root word. So inside the industry, there's a tendency to think, or even 50 years ago, people would say, well, broadcasting is one thing, the radio, telecommunications is another thing. But one thing you realize in the book, which is very interesting, is you realize that at the very early stages of most of these technologies, there's a plasticity as to what they will be. So, for example, the radio was invented in the 1890s. And for a very long time, it was just used from point-to-point communications, i.e. it was sort of a substitute for the telephone. But the idea of broadcasting didn't become popular until 25 years after the invention. Similarly, telephone, for a while, people thought the best use of the telephone was going to be for mass entertainment. So they'd have concerts on the telephone. Sometimes there was news services on the telephone. There's some towns where the phone would ring 10 times at a certain time of day, and then you'd pick up the phone and you would hear the news and weather and some gossip and so. So there, and these were local, very interesting, because these were often local groups. So there would be you can imagine a small town. There's one town I studied carefully in New Mexico, where you have this small town and then there's a band, and at like 8 p.m. they have a performance and everyone's got their telephones. Everyone in the town has got their, not the town, but these are farms, so they're sort of spread out. Everyone in the is just listening. It's their evening entertainment. Let's pick up the telephone and listen to the band play, which I guess is somewhere at the central switching station. So there's a plasticity in what all these technologies are. It's made more obvious by the Internet, because the Internet can carry any video or voice or anything. It's more obvious. And so, yeah, I chose the word information because I think it's least associated with either being the phone or the radio or film. They're all fundamentally ways of moving information. And I guess it's premised, I don't want to go on forever on this, but it's premised on the idea that there is something special about information as a product. That's what you said in the introduction. Something different about information and orange juice. Or boots. Or even steel. One of the things I find is very interesting in the book is the people who get interested, they're always men. The men who are heading these empires, they're often motivated by something very different than money or regular success. But some opportunity, I think the opportunity to control people's minds has a real persuasive influence for people who become information emperors. They're a different breed. You see this with today's media moguls, even any of them. There is something more deeply appealing, I think, about information. Information is not a normal product because it affects information you're presented with profoundly affects who you become, what you aspire to, what people think. So that's the reason I use the word information. That's a very interesting question. I mean, it's hard to tell because I got to repeat the question. So the question is whether consumers have changed in the way they react to things. Is that the right? Whether there's similarities in the way people reacted to radio and telephone and film and the way they people reacted to the internet, right? You know what actually got me, just speaking of people who have personally been through this, one of the people who I talked to about this book idea at one point was Justice Stevens on the Supreme Court. And he says, he's a guy who remembers meeting Babe Ruth. And we're talking about the internet, and he says, yeah, I remember when radio was... That actually kind of got me started on my book in some ways, because he said, I remember when the radio was just getting started. I was thinking like, wow, come on. You know what I mean? He said, we thought that was really exciting. And now we think the internet's exciting. It's hard to tell, because all you have to go by is, you know, newspaper accounts or talking to people. Let me say what I think is similar and what I think is different. So what I think is similar is that consumers tend to be extremely excited by the novelty of things at first, but then after a while, you know, so they're very excited and they have these huge booms. Throughout this history, you see there's booms that happen. There's a repeated pattern of booms. You know, 1 minute there's 100 radio stations and there's a million radio stations. Not a million, but, you know, thousands of them. But then they also tend to have this pattern, like I said, of becoming dissatisfied with quality problems, reliability problems. A lot of people left Bell's rivals, not only because Bell destroyed them, but because they didn't feel the service was good, their equipment was shoddy, and so forth. So there is that pattern of getting really excited about something and then wanting more at a second point. What I think might be different, let me think, a few things that are different. I think there is at some stage more resistance to commercialism in earlier ages. There was a long time in radio early history where there was a massive movement against any advertisements on radio. People said, in fact, Herbert Hoover, you don't necessarily think as a sort of left-wing dude or something. He said it would be an abomination to have advertisements on the radio. It's such a miracle of science to be wasted with commercial chatter is just unthinkable. So I think there was in previous times an almost stronger, much natural sense of that the commercial should not come into different areas. And you think about how much we've abandoned that when Facebook starts and we don't even think, oh, you know, Google Maps are free or... You know, we don't sort of think about them as commercial entities. No, I mean, have you ever thought, oh, I'm not going to use Google because it has ads or because it's commercial? People, I don't think they have this, I don't think we have that same sensitivity that was around to some extent. There's more. It's a really good question, and let me say one more thing. I think that maybe, that's on one side. I think on the other side, it's hard to tell if it's consumers or just Americans. I think there was more of a worship of size in the early part of the 20th century than we have today. This idea that everything needed to be massive and an incredible faith in science and centralized systems, basically. So progress is always bigger and more centralized. So the bigger, more centralized telephone system is always the better one. In the 30s, government taking charge of things and the smartest people running it was better. If you're into management theory, Frederick Taylor prescribed that every corporation should reorganize how it does everything to make people in the smart people in the center run things, not the people in the shop. Right? So there was this faith, and I think we live in a different age where there's more. There's been the 70s. There was a huge reaction against this in the 70s. Small is beautiful, and essentially everything in the 60s and 70s was in some ways a rejection of letting the Pentagon and letting a couple agencies and a huge corporations run everything. They were like, you know, maybe we've gone too far with the centralization thing. The failure of the Soviet Union made centralized economic planning look a little less attractive. And obviously the Second World War made you think that there may be incredible centralization of everything can become totalitarianism. So there's this change in people's attitude and love for centralization, I think, changed. And our, you know, Jane Jacobs is a very popular urban planner who people think the internet's great, Wikipedia, which did centralize. There's a much more, in our times, of a natural urge to think that small, local, decentralized is a good thing. Okay, the question is whether the internet is in some ways fundamentally different because you have a pattern of you have a pattern whereby companies can start on top of another company's platform, right? That's part of what the internet revolution was all about. So let me talk about AT&T because it's close to this analogy. AT&T, that was always something that was, what you're talking about was always possible. I have a story in my book of a man who sells a device for putting over your telephone. This is the 1930s. Or actually, eventually the 1950s. It's a device you put over your telephone so people can't hear you when you talk, like this. So he wants to sell something that is in some sense on the AT&T platform. Everyone has a phone. He wants to sell an add-on to the phone like this, right? And so that you can't, and seems like reasonable. He sells it for a reasonable price. AT&T takes him to court to try to prevent him from selling this device. They see it as an abomination. And they say the entire phone system will be threatened if someone other than us is allowed to innovate on top of our platform. AT&T was opposed to anything that was called a foreign attachment, in their words. That is to say, anything made by someone other than them was banned from the system. So they ran this poor guy, Tuttle, around for decades, But that was just the least of it. Things like answering machines. AT&T, I talk about my book, I found this memo where AT&T had invented the answering machine in the early 1930s. In fact, they'd invented the tape recorder. But once they started thinking about this is Bell Labs, they said, you know what? We have to destroy this technology. The reason is if there's tape recorders, people are going to stop using the telephone. Someone's going to tape their conversation. They might be talking about something embarrassing or obscene. So we, AT&T, have to stop this technology in order to preserve the greater value of the system. The system above everything. So the very idea of the internet revolution was to say, listen, maybe it's not the best thing to have one person in charge of everything. AT&T has been very innovative, but this idea of just only AT&T makes the phones and you can't sell a little device to go over the head. It's not a good idea. So anyway, I don't know if it fully answers your question, but what you're seeing when you see companies based on another company is at its heart the internet, the idea of the internet revolution. Yeah, that's a great question. The latter question is a question which I've been... Now, I don't want to spend a huge amount of time talking about media because I could spend forever and I mostly want to talk about the book. But just briefly, I in the book I do talk about the role of the FCC, which is a very federal government in the history of monopoly and information. And it's a challenging role because the FCC can discipline monopolists. The government can break up monopolies through antitrust, like it blew up at Bell in 1984, which was, if you actually think about it, the reason the internet started was because Bell got blown up. People don't always put these two things together. But there are these moments where decisive government action has a big effect, particularly, I would say, blowing up companies. I'd hate to be, I'm not going to say you should blow up every company, but when the time comes, the history to me fairly convincingly proves that nothing has the effect on revitalizing a stagnant sector or giving it back to the people in some ways than blowing up a monopolist that has gone too far. Just a fact. The film industries are another one that's studied in the book, and breaking them into pieces, which they eventually cut them vertically in the 50s, made a big difference. But what can you ask from the FCC? The FCC has a very interesting history because it, at times, does nothing but support monopoly and keep monopolists alive beyond any time that they should be dead. They protected NBC and CBS for decades against cable television. Cable television invented in the 1950s and really didn't start getting anywhere to the mid-70s. Reason because they were under intense federal regulation that just stopped the business, or stopped it from being in any cities, which is the same as stopping the business. So I think you have to be very cautious. Now, what can you do, you know, to demand that the FCC does the right thing? I do think public pressure ultimately matters, and I do think that having the kind, you know, even just showing up today and becoming interested in basically American information and who controls it is extremely important. I kind of, in the book, I write about this stuff as if it's, I write about what is often written by business writers, you know, the fate of companies in a more political and almost in a more political way, as more like the fate of nations. And I think that's how we have to think about these things, that they are, the people who run information companies, in some ways, should be as accountable as America's rulers. Because they have a profound influence on the shape of this country, beyond which, as I've said, shoelace manufacturers have. So I can talk to you later about all the particular details, but that's what I think matters ultimately. Okay, so the role of the military in the history, you know, the military has it's an interesting question. They come and go. The first real information monopolist in American history is Western Union, the telegraph company, which I want to suggest is also the most terrifying in history. If they were 150 years ago, there was one way to move information quickly from one place to instantly. You really had two choices, post office or the telegram. The telegram was instant. The post office took however long it took. And it was a monopoly ruled by one company, Western Union. A critical fact, and let me talk... Oh, no, let me stay with that. One company, Western Union, long-distance information movement. And what they did is they allied with the Associated Press which became the exclusive wire service for the nation. That is the exclusive source of instant news. So there's only one way you get news instantly, and that's through Western Union Associated Press duopoly. And they would just decide what they wanted the news to be on an instant basis. Most newspapers at the time, when you look at them, are about half Associated Press wires, because that's the only way you get instant news. And if it's something like war news, which I'm going to get to in a second, that's the news that you want to hear, and you're going to wait, you know, five-day-old news is not news. And that might be fine if, you know, they'd said do no evil or even vaguely had these kind of ideas, but actually they had the opposite ideas. They liked the Republican Party, and that was it. So they generally, with some exceptions, did what they could to keep the Republican Party in power, this monopoly over instant news. Whether that meant not broadcasting news related to candidates they didn't like, whether that meant spying on Democratic candidates when they sent telegrams, it was just blatant in those days. It was like, you know, people talk about 2000 and Fox News being bad. There's nothing like, particularly the election of 1876, you can't even compare today's kind of news bias to the Associated Press in the 1870s. The overlap was, you know, the people who worked at Associated Press were also in the Republican Party. There's one situation I have in the book where it's the night of the election in 1876, and it looks like the Democrat has won. But Western Union gets hold of a Democratic telegram suggesting the Democrats are a little unsure about the South. And somehow, so Western Union gives this to the New York Times office, of editors. The editors run, physically, one of the editors physically runs it over to the Republican Party, gets everyone up and says, claim the election, we're going to win this. Even though the Republicans had internally already conceded the election. So when you have the country's only mover of information on your side, it can make an incredible difference. And this may seem like a kind of abstract 150 years ago kind of thing, but imagine if Google became more powerful than even it is now, let's say. And I like Google, but imagine they just decided they liked one of the political parties in a profound way. They've got Gmail, or let's say Facebook and Google, put them together. They have Gmail, they have the ability to subtly alter search end results. If you look at the news page, if they put the news that is favorable to one candidate front of the front of the news and negative, you know, they're not all powerful, but it certainly helps. Now I can't. Oh yeah. So the military. The reason, one of the reasons the Western Union had this kind of power is the Lincoln administration during the Civil War. Liked the Western Union monopoly because this was their advantage against the Confederates in setting up the. So often the military side of the administration finds it more convenient to have a monopolist in charge of communications. AT&T had a long partnership with the federal government, and so the first time, in fact, that the antitrust department tried to break up AT&T, the Defense Department killed it. They said AT&T is essential to national defense. We must have a monopoly in charge of American communications. In fact, AT&T ran for years, kind of amazing. They ran laboratories with access to nuclear technology. So you had a private company, you know, which everyone kind of trusted, that actually had access to nuclear bombs. That is a level of trust between the federal government and its greatest monopolist. It's fascinating to me because the American Revolution was, people talk about the Tea Party, that was a revolution against crown monopolies in some ways. The original Tea Party was a revolution in some way against the British East India Company. But it's fascinating to me that even though this was the sort of spirit, we have this tendency to go back and create crown monopolies. Go back and create all-powerful companies that are deeply supported by government, whether it's the financial sector, which has been an arm of government. I don't know why we call it a private sector, because when it fails, it is part of government. I mean, it's a proof it's part of government is, can you fail? Our major car manufacturers or our major airplane, they're all quasi-crown corporations in the sense that they are not allowed to fail. So, sorry, this is a little bit. The military also, yeah, so that's enough on the military. Now, it doesn't have the same patterns that you have in the financial sectors or so on. The most obvious candidate would be AT&T and Verizon because they have the longest history. And they have the advantage of the reason AT&T and Verizon. No one here has ever said, you know, I'm going to start a mobile. You might start an app company, but you're never going to start a mobile phone company right now. And that's because to get started in that market, you need about $10 billion to talk about getting started. And even then, you're facing companies that are deeply entrenched. So the companies that have the closest relationship to government are AT&T and Verizon. The Bell. I mean, they're still AT&T. It's the Bell. So they're the ones that have the closest. And they're the ones that are least vulnerable to competition, in a sense. Right? If you look at our cast of characters today who are powerful information companies, I think possibly Google, they could be displaced. It's much harder to displace the phone companies. Yeah. No, it's a great question. The question is whether, I said that AT&T and Verizon have certain advantages from their relationship with government. Is the mobile internet going to change everything? First of all, I don't want to suggest that AT&T. The previous question was who are today's crown monopolists? And one thing I just want to suggest is the phone companies still have a closer relationship to government. It doesn't mean that they're all powerful. It means that they're much less vulnerable to competition. So that's the first thing. Second thing I wanted to say about mobile, what's very interesting today is if you look at notice if you start using your computer less and using your mobile phone more. I'm not saying that's a terrible thing. It's never convenient. They're great devices. But these are devices with very different histories and legacies. Mobile phones, while they're more like computers, are still fundamentally telephones. And so they ideologically have inherited the DNA of the first telephone in 1876 and are fundamentally much more closed devices, generally speaking. They're generally devices that have a, if you look at the iPhone, for example, it has a much more controlled experience. And so I think we are definitely seeing with the phones. The phones, I would say, are one of the major examples of a move towards a more closed internet. Now, Google is trying to fight this with Android and so forth, but the rise of the mobile phone and the decline, the relative decline of computers is one of the examples of what I'm talking about. It's one thing, I want to fold that into a conversation about censorship and privacy. The only thing I'll say, and it's very clear, is that when you study the history of all these, of these industry, centralization, one company ruling everything, always makes it easier or always creates problems of private censorship and privacy and violations. And it's obvious because one company having access to everything is just much more is a more effective infringer of privacy or user privacy. The disaggregated, fragmented, open systems, everyone has a little piece of information. It's not necessarily that useful. Particularly true, I'm going to talk a little bit more about censorship because it's something the book talks more about than privacy. There were a lot of efforts in the 20s to censor the film industry. Success was so-so. The reason, again, is the industry had hundreds of producers, thousands of people. A film would be made. It would be supposedly banned, but you could still play in some theaters and pay the fine or bribe people. So there was this film censorship in the 20s was attempted but not always successful. The period when film censorship became incredibly effective in the 1930s, when the industry had consolidated into six major studios. And then the Catholic Church, not the studios themselves, but the Catholic Church, which had previously written a code as to what film should be, went to the six integrated companies and said, you must clear all of your scripts with us before you make these movies, or we will boycott Hollywood. And so we had a system from about 1934 to 1968 where every single Hollywood film went through the Catholic Church before it was made into a film. Not before it was shown, before it was made at all. And ultimately you had one guy, his name is Joseph Breen, who made the decision. So you had one man deciding the content of American film. That's the influence of consolidation. All right, thank you very much.